Most of us are by now aware, I guess, that this year is the bicentennial of the founding of Australia. Not the finding of Australia, of course. As the Aborigine people have been keen to impress upon us, they knew it was there all along. But as far as the European settlements are concerned, 1788 marked the beginning, and no one can blame our Australian cousins from taking the opportunity to display a little pride in their achievements these last 200 years. I noticed Harry Braden's there at the back to remind us too. What I suspect may have slipped our notice, however, in this vast media courage of the Antipodean celebrations, is that 1988 is also the 400th anniversary of what I think must be regarded as a far more historically important event, and one which, as far as we're concerned, took place much closer to home. In May 1588, a formidable fleet of 130 ships set out from Lisbon. They aimed to join the land forces of the Duke of Parma at Calais, and from there to launch an invasion of England. Had that audacious plan succeeded, Britain would have become part of a vast Spanish Catholic empire, which would have embraced most of Europe. As it was, that huge armada was routed. King Philip II's imperialist ambitions were halted, and the independence of these islands and the survival of the Protestant Reformation was secured. Now, frankly, as far as political significance goes, the planting of a few penal colonies in New South Wales doesn't come into the same league as that. Indeed, it's sobering to consider that had that invasion of 1588 taken place, in all probability they'd be speaking Castilian in Australia now, not that strine dialect that passes for English down under. However, if we're realistic, I think we have to say that in these days of EEC cooperation between London and Madrid, not to mention ecumenical dialogue between Canterbury and Rome, it is most unlikely that they're going to be letting off any fireworks over the Thames in celebration of the sinking of the Armada, as they have been doing over Sydney Harbour this past week. Oh, come the summer, we may see a few commemorative events to boost the tourist trade on Plymouth Hoe, but that will be about the limit of it. In terms of public awareness, 1988 is going to do far more for the discoveries of Captain Cook than it's ever going to do for the victories of Francis Drake. All of which raises an interesting question, doesn't it? What determines the events of the past that we choose to remember? Why do we commemorate some things and forget others? It was the philosopher Hegel who made the famous comment that the only thing we learn from history is that people never learn from history. And I'm afraid most of the time he's right. For a start, our memories are so selective, aren't they? We remember our victories so much more readily than we remember our defeats. But more than that, our memories are often very distorted too. We romanticize the past in a way that makes us feel good about ourselves, when what we really need to do is to face up maybe to some rather unpalatable aspects of historical truth. And the result of all that is that the past, though it has much to teach us, is rarely given the opportunity to teach us. History repeats itself, says the proverb. Well, of course it does. It's bound to, since we human beings are so slow to profit from it. That's one of the fascinating things I find about the book of Deuteronomy, indeed about the whole Bible. Moses was determined to prevent Israel from recycling her past mistakes in that futile and tragic manner. In the 40 years since she had come out of Egypt, she had learned many lessons. And in the years to come, as she entered the promised land, Moses knew she would learn many more lessons. Well, it was vital that as the centuries went by, those lessons were not lost, but were rather woven into her national consciousness. So again and again, as you read this book of Deuteronomy, you find one word constantly recurring. Remember. 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 It's the key word of our passage today in verse 7. Remember, says Moses, and never forget. Well, this morning, in this fifth study of our series, A Nation Under God, I want us to examine together the kind of remembering which Moses is instructing the Israelites to engage in this passage. Because the principles he lays down in this chapter are not unique to Israel, as I hope we shall see at the end of our study. History has lessons to teach Britain, too. And many of our problems as a nation today arise from nothing more than our failure to learn them. Let's divide our Bible study, then, into three sections. First of all, I want us to look at verses 1 to 6. Where Moses, it seems to me, is instructing the people in how to interpret the victories of the past. Secondly, in verses 7 to 24, he's emphasizing the importance of being honest about the failures of the past. And thirdly, in verses 25 to 29, I think Moses is illustrating what I'd like to call the forgotten factor in national survival. When we've looked at those three sections, we'll be in a position to apply Moses' advice, not just to Israel, but to our own national memories. Let's start then with verses 1 to 6. How do we interpret the victories, the successes of the past? Hear, O Israel, you're about to cross Jordan to go in and dispossess nations greater and stronger than you, with large cities that have walls up to the sky. The people are strong and tall, Anakites. You know about them and have heard it said, who can stand up against the Anakites? But be assured today that the Lord your God is the one who goes across ahead of you like a devouring fire. He will destroy them. He will subdue them before you, and you will drive them out and annihilate them quickly, as the Lord has promised you. Here's the key. After the Lord your God has driven them out before you, do not say to yourself, the Lord has brought me here to take possession of this land because of my righteousness. Now those of you who have been following this series, well, I'm sure remember, Moses is addressing the Israelites here as they are camped on the east bank of the River Jordan, poised to begin their conquest of the promised land. And it's important for us to understand what a terrifying prospect that must have been for them. During the last couple of years of their long trek across the wilderness, they had gained some limited experience in warfare, it is true, defeating the notorious Og, king of Bashan, and Sion, king of Heshbon. But these were small fry in comparison with the formidable foes that awaited them on the other side of that River Jordan. Numerically, they were outmanned. Militarily, they were outgunned. And most demoralizing of all, there was a widespread belief among the Israelites that some of the Canaanite fortifications they would have to attack were inhabited by giants, the legendary sons of Anak. And no doubt those rumors were exaggerated by over-fertile Israelite imaginations. But the fear was far from being pure superstition. There is clear evidence from a number of Old Testament sources that there was indeed a warrior race of colossal size in the ancient world. And it wasn't just scaremongering to suggest that some of these titans were present in the land of Palestine. For the Israelites knew they were there. They had seen them. Those of you who know your Bibles well will perhaps remember that just a couple of years after the Exodus from Egypt, Israel had arrived at a place called Kadesh Barnea, on the southern borders of the Promised Land. And from there they had sent in 12 spies to reconnoiter the terrain in preparation for an immediate invasion. But unfortunately, with the laudable exception of Joshua and Caleb, the reports these scouts brought back were full of defeatism. The sons of Anak are there. They're huge. We felt like insects in comparison to them. And you should see their cities. The walls are so high they nearly reach the clouds. So discouraged were the Israelites by this intelligence information, they flatly refused to obey Moses' instructions to embark on the planned invasion. Indeed, that's how it was. They came to be wandering in the wilderness all these years. It had been the penalty for their cowardice at that critical moment in their history. Well, now, 40 years on, they were back at square one again, preparing to enter the same territory. So it's a little surprise that those old scare stories about the sons of Anak, no doubt much embroidered by generations of repetition now, were being recirculated. It's clear in these early verses that Moses feels part of his task as he addresses the people is to silence those alarmist fears that were being generated by these stories and reassure them there was no need for panic. Listen, he says, you're going to win. You really are going to win. In a few years' time, your history books will be crammed with the records of your military triumphs against these Canaanite people you now fear so much. And when that day comes, it won't be cowardice any longer that is your problem, but an overweening self-confidence. Learn then now, he says, the way you are to interpret the victories which you will one day be commemorating. Lest in the smug self-satisfaction of your achievements, your memory distorts the truth, and you forget the real explanation of your success. First, he says, you must remember that it was God's strength, not yours, that prevailed in these victories. Verse 3, be assured today the Lord your God is the one who goes across ahead of you like a devouring fire. He will destroy them. He will subdue them. He will drive them out. Moses is anticipating the way that, drunk with the heady wine of victory, the Israelites would find it so easy to forget the inadequacy they were feeling right now on the east bank of Jordan. The temptation would be to attribute their success to their superior military power and tactics. No, he says. That is not the way you are to interpret the history of conquest. Let the gnawing pangs of terror that are gripping your stomachs right now be imprinted upon your memories, so that in the day of triumph you'll be under no illusion about why you won the battle. It is God's strength, not yours, that has overcome the sons of Anak. He is the true victor, not you. Furthermore, he says, remember not just that it is God's strength that prevailed in the battles, not you. Remember, secondly, that it was God's justice that was vindicated in the victory, not yours. When the Lord has driven them out before you, don't say to yourself, the Lord has brought me here to take possession of this land because of my righteousness. No! It's on account of the wickedness of these nations the Lord is going to drive them out before you. So even if our memories are honest enough to recall that the battle wasn't won by our own strength, there yet remains the further temptation to attribute success to our virtue, isn't it? God made us win as a reward for our moral superiority. No, says Moses again. That is not the way you are to interpret your history. Undoubtedly, God does judge among the nations. And undoubtedly, he does use war as an instrument of his retribution on the political and on the international stage. But if he chooses to employ you, Israel, in such a judicial role, you are not to assume that implies he finds you less morally obnoxious than these corrupt nations you are being used to punish. On the contrary, he says, in your own way, you're just as bad, if not worse. No, it's to the undeserved mercy and grace of God that you are to attribute your victory. He is keeping the covenant promise he made to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, he says. A promise you never deserved in the first place. A promise which you have repeatedly despised during these past 40 years. Don't commit the blunder then of thinking that your righteousness is a factor in your victory. It is not. It is God's strength that has prevailed, and it is God's justice that has been vindicated. And it's precisely to deliver you from the possibility of that misconception that Moses put so much stress on the word remember. And that brings us to the second section of our passage, doesn't it? The importance of being honest about the failures of the past. Remember this, he says, and never forget how you provoked the Lord your God to anger in the desert. It's quite clear from the book of Exodus and Numbers that Moses is not exaggerating here. The story of Israel's wandering in the wilderness had been one of constant grumbling and complaint. In fact, if you look down to verses 22 and 23 of our passage, you'll find Moses actually lists some of the typical incidents that Numbers and Exodus record. You made the Lord angry at Taberah, he says in verse 22. This was an occasion when the Israelites moaned so much about their hardships on the journey that God sent some kind of supernatural fire among them as a rebuke. Then he says there was the occasion of Massa. It was lack of water there that gave rise to the discontent. Why didn't you leave us in Egypt, they said. Why bring us out into the desert to make us die of thirst? Then there was Kibroth Hataava, an incident recorded in Numbers 11, when they got fed up with their daily provision of manna and demanded some animal protein to mix in their diet as well. If only we had meat, they said. We had meat in Egypt. And then, of course, there was Kadesh Barnea. That incident we've already mentioned. When they refused to enter the promised land for fear of the giants there. If only we died in the desert, they said. Why has the Lord brought us out to fall by the sword? We'd be better off back in Egypt. So it went on. It's a wonder Moses survived, you know. Few pastors would have stayed 6 months with such a congregation of malcontents. Moses put up with it 40 years. Now, he knew what he was talking about when he said they were a rebellious bunch. Neither was he exaggerating when he said that they had been that way right from the moment they'd left Egypt. For the most outrageous exhibition of this bolshy, mutinous attitude among them was, in fact, the very first. It happened within a matter of weeks of the Exodus. It happened, of all places, at Mount Sinai, the holy mountain where the covenant had just been ratified days before. Scarcely had the ink dried on the covenant than the Israelites were already flouting its terms. And that, of course, is the incident that Moses chooses to describe in great detail in this chapter, from verse 8 onwards. At Horeb, he says, you aroused the Lord's wrath so that he was angry enough to destroy you. When I went up on the mountain to receive the tablets of stone, the tablets of the covenant the Lord had made with you, I stayed on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights, eating no bread, drinking no water, and the Lord gave me 2 stone tablets inscribed by the finger of God. And at the end of those days, the Lord told me, go down from here at once. Because your people whom you brought out of Egypt have become corrupt. They have turned away quickly from what I commanded them, have made a cast idol for themselves. Any of you who've seen Cecil B. DeMille's motion picture epic of the Ten Commandments will recall, I'm sure, the graphic portrayal he makes of this scene. Moses, having just received the 2 tablets of the covenant, the law of God, coming down the mountainside, first to meet his young lieutenant Joshua. And as they near the Israelite encampment, they hear noise. Joshua's first thought is to think the camp must be under attack, but Moses has already been told by God what to expect. No, he says, that isn't the noise of war I'm hearing. The noise of merriment. So as they come within eyeshot of the camp, they observe the Israelites, in fact, engaged in a wild, orgiastic celebration of this golden calf, which of all people Aaron, the high priest, had manufactured for them to worship in Moses' absence. These be your gods who brought you out of the land of Egypt, he told them. There can have been few moments in Moses' entire life charged with more emotional intensity than that moment as he stood on the hillside and saw that camp. In fact, I think you can feel with him, can't you, as he writes here in the first person, the collision of disappointment and the anger and the heartbreak and the indignation he felt at the spectacle of this pagan obscenity. I looked and I saw you had sinned against the Lord your God. You turned aside quickly from the way the Lord had commanded you. So I took the two tablets and threw them out of my hand, breaking them to pieces before your eye. Never could Moses forget the passion that tore his soul as those precious tablets fell from his hand. That moment must have been etched indelibly upon his memory. He could hardly think about it without reliving the emotion of that moment. It comes through even now, 40 years later, as he repeats the story to us here in Deuteronomy 9. But the Israelites could forget. Oh yes, they could forget all too easily. That kind of national humiliation is all too conveniently blotted out of our history books, isn't it? The victories, the achievements, the successes. Oh, we like to record them. We like to celebrate them. But the failures, the defeats, the scandals, the blunders, the outrages, the vices. And to those we prefer to turn a blind eye, don't we? Yet you see, as Moses so firmly implies in that key verse 7, it's only out of such honest, if embarrassing, memories that a true assessment of our national history can be built. Remember, he says, and never forget how you provoked the Lord your God. See, nations, like individuals, have egos to protect. And so often we do it by constructing myths about our own virtue. We are the goodies, everybody else is the baddies. Being goodies, we always win. That's how the stories in our children's comics go. That's how the plots in our war films and our spy thrillers go. We are the goodies, everybody else is the baddie, that's why we win. It's the Nazis and the Japs and the communists that do all the nasty things. Not us. That isn't the way it is. Israel was to remember her past failures, if anything, more vividly than she was to remember her victories. For only by remembering her past failures would she be able to identify the real reason for her durability as a nation. And that brings us to the third element in our study this morning. What I've called the forgotten factor in national survival. Look at verse 18. I fell prostrate before the Lord. Tennyson says, more things are wrought by prayer
than this world dreams of.
Well, Moses in this chapter is demonstrating for us that that is no mere pious platitude. It expresses a solid, practical reality. And a reality, mark you, not just in the experience of individuals, but in the political experience of whole nations, too. Israel's destiny hangs in the balance at this crucial moment of time. She had slapped the Lord God Almighty around the face, flirting with idols at the very moment he was roaring from the mountain, "Thou shalt not make for yourself a graven image." What was he going to do with her? It was not as if he had no other means to accomplish his eternal plan. Do you see how in verse 13 he dangles before Moses' eyes what must have seemed a most attractive alternative to God, at least? "Let me alone," he says, "so I may destroy them and blot out their name from under heaven, and I will make you into a nation stronger and more numerous than they." But such was Moses' commitment to this unworthy rabble he had rescued from Egypt, but that offer seems to have had no appeal to him at all. No, instead of grasping at the opportunity to supersede Israel, he chooses rather the opportunity to intercede for Israel. Verse 25, "I lay prostrate before the Lord those 40 days and 40 nights, because the Lord had said he would destroy you. I prayed to the Lord and said, 'O sovereign Lord, do not destroy your people, your own inheritance that you redeem by your great power.'" I think it's instructive to notice in those closing verses the grounds of Moses' prayer. For you'll observe he makes absolutely no excuses for Israel's conduct. There's no plea of mitigating circumstances or of diminished responsibility. Now, if the Lord had destroyed them, as he was threatening to do, there's no suggestion in Moses' prayer that he would be impeaching the divine justice for decreeing such a penalty. Moses asks for no concession to Israel's weakness at all. His whole prayer consists of an appeal to the strength, the character of God. Israel's weaknesses and character don't come into it. See how he appeals first to the consistency of God's purposes. Verse 26, "You brought them out. You redeemed them by your great power. Lord, you've invested so much in these people. How can you now turn around and think of destroying them?" He appeals secondarily to the faithfulness of God's promises. "Remember your oath," he says, "the promise you made to your servants, Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. You swore to those men that their children would inherit this land, no matter how appalling this insult. You can't destroy them without going back on that word." Thirdly, he appeals to God's concern for his own divine reputation. "What are the Egyptians going to think?" he says. "Because the Lord Jehovah wasn't able to take them into the land he promised them, and because he hated them, he brought them out into the desert to die." Don't you see that's what the Egyptians and all the other pagan nations are going to say? "That you're a powerless God, unable to fulfill the claim I've made for you as your prophet?" But perhaps most compelling of all, he appeals to the possessiveness, the fierce possessiveness of an unchangeable divine love. See in verse 29, "But they are your people." Your inheritance. You brought them out by your great power and your outstretched arm. You can't miss, can you, the emphasis on those second person possessive pronouns. It isn't just them that you are depriving if you destroy them, Lord. You are depriving yourself.
I don't know about you, but I find something extraordinarily moving about that prayer. Here is a man, a single individual, and the fate of a whole nation hinges on this exchange he is having in secret with God. Seems impossible, doesn't it? How can the private devotions of any man or woman possibly have such momentous significance? And yet the Bible regularly insists that they do. At the end of the day, it was not Israel's military strength or lack of it. It was not Israel's righteousness or lack of it that was the vital factor. The key factor in her survival as a nation was the intercession of one man whom God raised up to stand in the breach of her national failures and sue for his mercy on her behalf. Do you notice how in verse 14 God says, "Let me alone"? Incredible as it may seem, Moses seems to have had a hold over God in this matter. Don't misunderstand me. He couldn't tell God what to do. The whole prayer is marked by the most abject humility. "I lay prostrate before the Lord," he says. Flat on his face, squirming in the dirt. That was the only place Moses felt any representative of Israel could be before God at such a time of gross apostasy. But his prayers from that prostrate position were not the weak, ineffectual whimpers of a beggar. They were courageous and dignified appeals based on his knowledge of God's revealed word and character. And Deuteronomy leaves us in no doubt. Those prayers were effective. Those prayers changed the course of Israel's history at this critical moment in time. Verse 19, "I feared the anger and the wrath of the Lord. He was angry enough with you to destroy you. But the Lord listened to me." And if that was true for Israel, and I want to suggest to you this morning that it's true for this country too. For 900 years now, you know, since the Norman conquest, these islands have never been conquered by a foreign army. Few nations in the world have a boast like that. It's a remarkable record of national survival. To what are we going to attribute it? To the diplomacy of our politicians? To the strategy of our generals? To the courage of our soldiers? To the tenacity of our people? To the moral quality of our Christian civilization, even? I suggest to you, Deuteronomy 9 strongly suggests that we should attribute such national survival to the prayers of the saints. In fact, if you'll allow me, I will give you two concrete illustrations from our history, which I am convinced demonstrate that. For the first, let's go back to that famous incident with which we began. The sinking of the Spanish Armada 400 years ago. Do you know, not a single English ship was lost in that naval engagement. Fewer than 100 English lives were lost. Patriotic history books attribute the victory to a number of things. Some attribute it to the quality of British shipbuilding, which provided us with vessels that were faster and more maneuverable than the cumbersome Spanish galleons. Some attribute it to the competence and experience of British sailors who for centuries had plied the English Channel where the action all took place. Some attribute it to the superiority of the British command. Charles Howard, a brilliant admiral with Drake and Hawkins, the brilliant captains in his team. And all of this is undoubtedly true. But you know, if you read what actually happened in 1588, it is transparently clear the main reason for the British victory had nothing to do with the British Navy at all and everything to do with the British weather. No sooner had the Armada left Lisbon than they were battered by a gale that forced them to put into Corunna for a refit. And when they emerged 2 months later and at last arrived at Calais, they found the winds and the tides were so utterly unfavourable it made rendezvous with the land forces of the Duke of Parma in Calais quite impossible. And with the English fleet harassing them from behind, the Spanish had no alternative but to sail into the North Sea, and no sooner were they there than a series of gales blew that entire fleet to pieces. Some were wrecked on the coast of Norway, some on the coast of Scotland. Those brave ships that succeeded in a complete northern circuit of Britain found themselves driven on the rocks on the west coast of Ireland. In all, only 76 of the original 130 vessels got back to Spain. It was an extraordinary deliverance. And in its day, it staggered the whole of Europe. No one could believe it. Everyone believed Spain was invincible. And to give her credit, Queen Elizabeth I gave due recognition to the real source of that victory. Both on the medal she ordered struck to commemorate the battle, and on the monument, which to this day you can still see overlooking Plymouth Sound, she ordered a quotation from an old translation of Psalm 18 to be engraved. He blew with his winds, and they were scattered. I suggest to you it was the merciful providence of God that delivered these islands from the Spanish Armada. And that everybody in England at that time knew it was so, confessed that it was so. And do you want to know why I think the winds of God blew so contrary to King Philip of Spain's plans? Well, I will tell you. I believe it was a direct answer to the prayers of hundreds of thousands of Protestant believers who at that time found England just about their only refuge in the whole of Europe from Catholic persecution. Having been delivered from the superstition and tyranny of the medieval church, they were desperate that England should remain a haven of tolerance and safety for the religion of the Bible. And in their thousands, they prayed for deliverance from Spanish conquest for that reason. The Spanish Armada was not defeated by English ships, but was defeated by the prayers of English believers. But you do not have to go back 400 years to find that kind of evidence of the power of prayer in the history of our people. 50 years will do just as well. Some of you here can remember, I'm sure, those dark days of the summer of 1940. The British forces had been forced to evacuate from Dunkirk. France had submitted to German occupation. The whole continent of Europe that summer had been completely overrun by the Nazi war machine. German tanks, panzer divisions, were standing on the French coast opposite the Straits of Dover. 25 miles of English Channel was all that separated this country from invasion. And Hitler was already boasting to his staff that he would succeed where Philip of Spain had failed. So why did he not come? Hitler's reluctance to launch an invasion of England in 1940 must remain the greatest unanswered mystery of the entire Second World War. Yet I ask myself, why should such inexplicable providences be a surprise to us? For you see, this country, in 1940, was still, to a very large extent, a nation of praying people. We had a praying Prime Minister, for a start. Churchill made all kinds of misjudgments in the last war. But one thing I think is absolutely clear about that man, both from his speeches and from the testimony of those who knew him personally, and that is that he frequently spent time alone with God and was profoundly conscious of the deep dependence this country had on the sovereign intervention of God for her defense. We had praying generals in 1940. Many of them, perhaps the most outstanding, General Sir William Dobie, who was governor of Malta. Many of you will know the courageous story of that little island under siege. One of the most famous stories of the war. What is less well known is the consistent way in which General Dobie publicly exhorted his officers and soldiers to put their trust in God, quoting even from the book of Deuteronomy often. We had a praying king in 1940. Again, some of you here, I'm sure, will powerfully recall the compelling effect that King George VI's Christmas broadcast at the end of 1939 had. I said to the man who stood at the gate of the year, "Give me a light, that I may tread safely into the unknown." And he replied, "Go out into the darkness and put your hand into the hand of God. That will be better to you than light and safer than a known way." This was no public school religion. This was the evidence of a sovereign whom all agree had a sincere personal relationship with God. We were a praying people in 1940. Some of you again will remember how the King George himself called the entire nation to a day of prayer on the 8th of September at the very height of the Battle of Britain. And how thousands upon thousands responded, how the churches were packed and Westminster Abbey was packed with praying people. So desperate were we that we were on the very threshold of defeat. But most of all, we had a praying church in 1940. Any of you who have read Norman Grubb's biography of Rhys Howells will perhaps remember the way in which, as director of the Bible College of Wales in Swansea, that man led direct and sometimes quite remarkably specific prayer throughout the war years for the survival of our nation. He was just one of many thousands of believers who, like Moses of old, were praying for the nation. Not out of any jingoist illusion about our military might or our moral superiority. Christians in 1940 knew how vulnerable we were. They knew, too, how far as a nation we had declined from the vigorous Christian commitment of those days of revival and reformation in centuries past. They prayed as Moses praised. Not that God would give us a victory we deserved. We knew we deserved none. They simply prayed that God would defend the honor and the glory of his own name. How Satan will boast, they told God, if England with all its Christian heritage is lost. Lord, in your mercy, save us. And I put it to you that he did.
It was God's merciful providence that spared these islands from Spanish dominion in 1588. It was that same merciful providence that spared them from German domination under Adolf Hitler in 1940. And if time were available, our history books would furnish us with dozens of similar illustrations of God's grace to us as a people. It was not the valour of British armies that won these great deliverances. On every occasion, we were quaking with fear at the apparently invincible power of the enemy that confronted us. Who can stand against the Anakites, they were saying. And on each occasion, the Lord, sometimes by a turn of events so extraordinary that politicians and commanders themselves described them as miraculous, went ahead of us like a devouring fire and destroyed the forces that threatened our freedom. Why did he do that? Because Britain was a righteous country. We delude ourselves most dreadfully if we think that's what it's all about. After the Lord your God has driven them out before you, do not say to yourself, the Lord has brought me here to take possession of this land because of my righteousness. That is not the way we are to interpret history. Now, in our time, we have been morally corrupt, spiritually rebellious, just as Israel was. Moses says to us, as he said to them, remember and never forget how you have provoked the Lord your God to anger. Now, the key factor in our national survival these past 900 years has not been our power or our righteousness. It has been the prayers of the saints. Secret prayers. Earnest prayers. Humble prayers. Prayers, most of all, that have laid hold of the revealed Word of God. So if you're asking yourself today, what can I do to secure my country's future? What gesture can I make as a British citizen to express my concern, my patriotic concern, my legitimate concern for this land I belong to? Well, I say God may call you to do many things. He may call you to be a scientist or a doctor, a soldier or a sailor, a civil servant or a politician, a housewife, a mother. There are all kinds of vocations to which God may call you in the service of your country and of your people. But whatever your vocation in life, if we care for this nation and its history as a nation under God, then I suggest to you this morning, our ambition, above every other ambition, must be to be men and women of prayer. Well, let's pray together now.